Today's lecture, let me just make a few comments about the tutorial you made, or you did yesterday, and you will continue, I think, on Monday. So what you did was basically the following. So if you don't use any symmetries, you just diagonalize the Hamiltonian, you just get a bunch of energies, right? And then the point was that when you use the program where we use the momentum, or actually semi-momentum, but you can think of it as momentum. Well, let's say we just use momentum. Then, of course, you can identify these levels, and you can see, for example, that the ground state has momentum k equals zero. And then there should be some, probably this next level should have momentum k equals pi, and so on. And okay, you also use the magnetization conservation mz, but we don't use total spin. So if a level has spin s, we know that it should be s times s plus 1 fold degenerate. So you should be able to see a lot of degeneracies here, and when magnetization conservation is used, you can label those states. So for example, the ground state should have mz equals zero, and then you should actually have three levels with spin one. So you should have mz equals, well, so they should be degenerate, right? So you should find them at the same energy, but in the list you should have three of them. So you should have mz equals minus 1, 0, and plus 1, and so on. So you may ask, what's the point of all that? Well, so the point was just to see that when you do all these blocks, you really get the same states. So you should have been able to identify all of these states. Now, one thing, this program, using the magnetization conservation, really works with the number of up spins fixed. So of course the magnetization is 1/2 n up minus n down, and for a given magnetization, if it's not zero, the plus m and minus m states are also degenerate. So you should find states there that have plus m and minus m. But the block diagonalization was that program only does magnetization greater than or equal to zero. So if there were some degenerate levels there that you didn't identify in the blocks, one reason may have been that program actually doesn't do the blocks with negative magnetization. So I hope that wasn't confusing. Well, but anyway, these energy levels themselves, sometimes they are actually very useful for also saying something about the nature of the ground state. So for a given type of ground state, you will have different types of excitations, and often they are reflected in the level spacings. And for example, one can look at how the lowest excitation or some other excitation, how the gap between the ground state and that excitation scales with the system size. That often says something fundamental about the ground state itself, because it's related to how the ground state can be excited to a higher state. And today we will see some examples of that. But of course, with just the energies, you don't get full information. So what you want to do normally is to look at the lowest state, this state, and you will want to look at the wave function. But just the wave function doesn't tell you much. It's just a bunch of numbers. So normally what we do is we compute correlation functions and other things as well. But normally correlation functions give a lot of information, and that's what I want to focus on today. So I will talk about the physics of spin chains, a couple of different examples, and look at correlations. And then I hope I have time also today to talk about two-dimensional exact diagonalization. Okay, so let's let's look at the standard Heisenberg chain, so just the nearest neighbor interactions. We have mentioned it before. So we know that we have antiferromagnetic correlations, so sometimes it's useful to cancel out the sign. So if we look at the correlation function, it will be just S dot S itself will be negative for odd R, so we can cancel that sign out like this. So this will be all positive. So let's see how it decays with the distance. And now, since the chain, of course, is very small, when we do launches, we are limited to maybe up to 40 sites if we really push it, but here I will only do slightly smaller. So we cannot really see the asymptotic behavior of this. But let's see if we can do anything at all. So in this particular case, it's known, or let's say predicted from low energy field theories, that this should be the behavior. So one can map the low energy physics of these chains to continuum field theories, and that's what people have done. But those mappings are often not completely rigorous, so there's still often some question of whether it's really correct. So that's why it's important to actually check it with the model Hamiltonians as well. But regardless, this is the prediction that the correlations should decay like one over R, but with a logarithmic correction. So there can be no long-range order if we have this 1D chain with just short-range interactions, but the prediction is that the state is almost ordered in the sense that there are power law correlations instead of exponentially decaying ones. So let's see what we get here. Well, maybe I should mention something about how we compute these correlations as well. So we have discussed how to construct the Hamiltonian. And constructing some other operator, as I pointed out, is also very similar. So in this correlation function, you see it looks like the Hamiltonian, right? So if you write this in terms of SZ and the ladder operators, it looks like just the term in the Hamiltonian. Yes? Well, so this is at zero temperature. Yeah, so thanks. Because we look at one level, just the ground state. So we take that, so we in the Lanczos calculation, which is, this is what that's based on, we get the lowest state. So we get the whole wave function, and then we can look at the correlations in that wave function. And the way we do it, let me just flip back to what we talked about last time. So we have to do this, so without going through the details, but I mean it's basically operating with our operator on the state and then taking the overlap to get this matrix element. Well, one thing which is important to note is that if we use momentum states, we should actually make sure that this operator here also has zero momentum. So what does that mean? Because if it has finite momentum, it will actually transfer momentum to the state and we will get nothing. So what it means is that we should, when we measure a correlation function like this, we should actually average it over all I. We should, in principle, this is independent of this reference site I, right? Because we have translational invariance. But if we operate with it on a momentum state, so this itself is an operator that we measure. This is, in K-space, if we Fourier transform it, this is a sum of operators of many different momenta. And if you take such an operator and act on a state, you actually get a state which has some momentum corresponding to the operator. So what we want to do is to average this over all I, and then it becomes a zero momentum operator. So then when you act with it on your, let's say, ground state, which has k equals zero, you get another state which also has k equals zero, and then you can get a finite overlap. Well, then you got the correct overlap when you take the expectation value. So that's something to... Well, it's just technical. I mean, the way we work with momentum states, that's the best way to do it. Yeah?
The reason I asked about temperature is when you talk here about the correlation being the sign of critical state.
Right. So So that would be a quantum critical state. So I think I mentioned when we talked about phase transitions in general that, okay, I gave classical phase transitions as an example, and they occur as a function of temperature. But we can have phase transitions also in the ground state of quantum systems. So those, instead of the temperature, you would vary something else, some parameter in the Hamiltonian. So here there's nothing that's varied. It's just one model, but it turns out that model itself is at a critical point.
Okay.
Or at in a critical region, in fact.
So that there's a more general model that if you were to look at would return a parameter which at its critical point gives Heisenberg.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, yeah. Actually, today we will even look at examples of that. So. Okay, so what do we get here for this correlation function? So now I show two kinds of data. So these are for different system sizes. So let's look at this n equals 16. So then for n equals 16, my largest distance is 8. So this is this data set here. Because in a periodic system, I only want to go half the length of the system, otherwise it will just repeat itself. So this is what I get. And now I actually multiply by r here to cancel out that r. So the point is to see do we approximately get 1 over r. So then I go to 24 and 64, and you see this grow with the distance a little bit. If you look at the scale here, it's not growing, well, it's growing something like a factor of 2 over these distances. Sometimes it's actually better to look at the longest distance in a given chain, which is r equals n over 2, and look at the correlation at that distance as a function of the system size. So this is those red dots here. So now we can see that this is almost constant here, but slowly growing. So it's probably consistent with that form. But the chains are really too small to say for sure. So later when we do quantum Monte Carlo, we will look at this again, and then we can do chains that are thousands in length, and then we can see that much more clearly. So, okay, let's see. Let's look at the excitations also. So now, if we look at those energies that you did yesterday, and we can look at the energies as a function of the momentum, we can look at the lowest state for a given momentum, and then we take the difference in energy between those states and the ground state, which has momentum zero, then this is what you get. So the S equals 1, the triplet, is the lowest excitation. And it's actually the very lowest one is at pi, as you see here. And then there's a singlet excitation, which is just a little bit higher. And of course, there are lots of other excitations as well. And these kinds of excitations actually correspond to these spin-ons that we discussed before. So I already discussed the fact that if we look at this in a cartoon picture where we have Ising spins and flip one spin, then we get two domain walls that can separate from each other. And even in this quantum system, which doesn't have long-range order, nevertheless, this kind of topological property of the system is still there. So one can actually understand these excitations as due to two of these spin-ons. And that can actually be seen experimentally. So what I show here is some results from this kind of material, which is quasi one-dimensional. So it's not completely easy to see in this picture, but this is supposed to show, I think it's the red ones, which are the coppers where the spins are, and they are supposedly weakly coupled. It's not clear from this picture at all, actually. I should look for a better picture. But nevertheless, this material consists of weakly coupled chains. So they should behave like isolated chains on some energy scales that exceed the coupling between the chains. So these are neutron scattering results where one can actually measure the excitation spectrum, and this is plotted as a function of the wave vector, similar to as I do here, and then energy. So what I have here, this line here. So by the way, this solid line is the exact result for an infinite chain from this beta ansatz solution. I just compare with that. It's some simple sinusoidal form, actually. Yep.
What's going on to the very low?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Actually, the sad fact is I don't know. I don't know why these points have such huge deviations. For any, this chain is for a 32-side chain. All chain lengths have this kind of anomalous behavior here, and I have no idea where it comes from, and I haven't seen any place in the literature where this is actually discussed, but it's interesting, I don't know why. Anyway, so that curve here corresponds to this arc here, and it's, well, actually the units are different here. I think this is... yeah, so what my curve corresponds to this one, actually. Let's see, why is this normalized in a different way? 2 pi a. Well, I'm not quite sure about the units here now, but I'm sure that what I have is the one of these arcs. So these are different temperatures here. So this is the lowest temperature, and this is the highest temperature. So what you see in these neutron scattering experiments is that, okay, so you can excite these triplet states, so that's what neutron scattering measures. So a neutron comes in and it interacts with the spin system and it can excite a triplet. That's what it's doing. And then those triplets can have different energies, and actually here I just showed the lowest energies. So there are many other triplets too which have different energies, but the matrix elements, when you compute the scattering cross-section, is such that you get the most scattering intensity at the edge here. But actually this spin-on picture, so in the spin-on picture you have basically two independent particles that each of them can have some momentum and energy. And if you just assume a dispersion for the spin-on, well, it can even be computed. It's also some sort of sinusoidal form. Then if you have two spin-ons, you can have all combinations of momenta for those two spin-ons, and then you cover energies within this region here. So that's more or less where these neutron experiments see the spectral weight. Although the weight is so dominant here that it's actually not completely easy to see this. Yeah?
Presence of finite magnetic moment?
No. Well, no, I mean, so the ground state of these things is a singlet, right? And the neutrons should just excite the triplet. So, of course, this is finite temperature, so it's more complicated, but if we just focus on low temperature, you should basically understand this as a triplet excited from this singlet. So I don't think they detect a finite moment. There should be no magnetic fields here or anything. So, well, this is just the flavor of this. There are many materials, actually, where one can see signs of this Heisenberg spin 1/2 chain with these spin-on excitations. Okay, let's look at this chain with frustrated interaction. So we already talked about this before. So we have these two couplings, and I mentioned that at this special point there's an exact solution of this model, which we actually will look at next week. It's quite simple. So at that point, the ground state is twofold degenerate. So these are the kinds of ground states where this denotes a singlet. So that's at J2 over J1 is a half. So this ground state is completely different from the Heisenberg ground state, because here the spin correlations are very short range. They are not 1 over r decaying, they decay exponentially. Well, actually, in this case, they are really zero beyond distance 2. But if we are not exactly at this point, there will be fluctuations on top of this. And eventually, if we go towards the Heisenberg point, so we reduce this coupling J2, we will again get some behavior that corresponds to the chain. So we will get these 1/r correlations. So there's a phase transition, and it appears at something like coupling rate ratio 0.24. This is an example of a valence bond solid state. So let's look at some results for this chain. And actually, in your homework, you will do something similar. So this is a J1, J2 model. Maybe in your homework, you will do something with one more coupling there. But you will not look at all the couplings, just some special cases. Okay, so as we have discussed before, normally if you have a finite system, you should not expect really symmetry breaking. So in this special case, these in fact are exact ground states. So you can say, okay, I can prepare the system in that state and it will always stay like that. So you can break the symmetry. If you go away from those points, these are not exact eigenstates. You have some fluctuations, and the exact eigenstates correspond to some symmetric and antisymmetric combinations of states where the symmetry is broken. So, of course, also here, since those two states are completely degenerate at that point, you can form states with well-defined momentum. You can form states which have zero momentum or momentum pi out of these kind of symmetry broken states. So if we look at, for example, if we do Lanczos or something like that, we would not get these states when we work with momentum states. We would get actually the symmetric combination which corresponds to momentum zero and the antisymmetric combination which corresponds to momentum pi. And if we go away from that point, those two states would not have exactly the same energy. They would be split a little bit. It's very similar to if you do just a single particle in a double well. So you just have a single particle in this kind of state. So then you know that you have an antisymmetric and a symmetric wave function. And that the symmetric one should have, the symmetric one has lower energy. They will be degenerate if you have an infinite barrier, but for a finite barrier, they are not completely degenerate. So that's very similar to what we have here. We have, you can think of there being some sort of barrier to fluctuations between those kinds of states. And it's just a special case that they are exactly degenerate at this point. So let's see, how can we detect this state then? So if we take a finite chain, and if we just look at the nearest neighbor correlations, for example, if we really had broken the symmetry, we would find a strong correlation between those spins and a weaker correlation, stronger and so on. But if you just look at that in a finite system where the symmetry is not broken, if you look at the ground state, it has some momentum, probably k equals zero again, and all those bond correlations would be the same. We cannot detect it. So then we have to do something similar to what we do in the Ising model, for example, when we compute the order there. We don't look at the magnetization itself. We look at the magnetization squared. Or we look at a correlation function. So this is the kind of correlation function we would look at in this case. So we take this SI dot SI plus 1 on the nearest neighbor bonds, which are the kind of correlations that would oscillate if we had a symmetry broken state. But now we correlate that kind of correlator with another one. So this is a four-spin correlation. So now we can see if this R is, R is the distance between what I call the Bs here. So we can think of B as just some object that is defined like that. So if R is even, we should get a strong correlation. And if R is odd, we should get a weak correlation because it corresponds to, so the strong ones we get when both the first one and the second one is on a red site. Well, of course, it will be averaged with when they both are on the weak sites, but on average, you will get more of a contribution from when they are both on the strong ones. So here, I show you that we indeed can detect this in this correlation. So let's look at G equals 0.04, that's inside this valence bond solid state. And you see that this correlation function oscillates, and it appears to flatten out. So if we could do a really big system, this would decay a little bit more, but it would stay oscillating all the way to R equals infinity. Again, to really be 100% convinced of that, maybe you would like to do some other method where you can do a larger chain, but at least this is some indication. And of course, it helps to know that exactly at G equals 0.5, in fact, we know that this is exactly the ground state, so that makes it easier to believe that, well, maybe it's actually correct. Okay, now let's look at just the Heisenberg chain. So if we go to the Heisenberg chain where we don't have this kind of order, we can still measure this kind of correlation, and you can see that there is some signal, so there is some sort of valence bond correlations also in the Heisenberg chain, but you see that they decay very fast. And in fact, they decay as 1 over r also, like the spin correlations decay as 1 over r. These correlations, it turns out, also decay like 1 over r. Okay, so there's a critical point separating those behaviors, and it's around 0.24, and if we go there, we get these red dots. It turns out in that case, too, the correlation should decay like 1 over r according to these low-energy field theories. So you can take as an order parameter here if you just want to look at a number and look at the size dependence. You can take the difference between the longest distance and the next longest distance, so that reflects this dimerization at the longest distance. So this is what I plot here for different system sizes. So that's similar to something like the magnetization, where if we have a phase transition, it should be, if we have a disordered state with that order parameter, it should be zero for infinite size, because these, like we have here, these things decay away. And in an ordered state, it should be finite. So this is what you see here for different system sizes. So you see that, okay, around here, it's pretty clear. The convergence seems quite convincing that it's pretty much the same for these three system sizes, whereas here, there's a decay as a function of the system size. But from here, it's not at all clear, well, where is the critical point? But just based on this data, it's not easy to say. And actually, it turns out that this transition is rather special. Have you heard about Costalis-Stallis transition in your other courses? No? No, okay, so anyway, so you can ask your question in a minute. So it's what's sometimes called an infinite order transition. So instead of normally at the critical point, we have some power law which describes the order parameter. In this case, if we go to an infinite size, this order would start exponentially slowly here. So it's not described by just some exponent. In some sense, the exponent is infinite. So it's an exponential behavior instead of a power law. So it's quite difficult to see it. Yes, please, you had a question. All right. So that's why it's so difficult to see. So you need much larger systems to see a sharp transition. But it turns out that there's a very neat way to locate this phase transition, nevertheless. And that's using level crossings. So what is that?
So let's look at level crossings.
So this was what we already looked at for the Heisenberg chain. So we know that the ground state has momentum zero. Oops, what happened? Oh. The ground state has momentum zero. And the lowest excitation in that case is this triplet with momentum pi. And you see that there's also a singlet, which is quite low in energy there. So this kind of behavior should be expected for also this J1, J2 model, as long as we are in this kind of critical phase, critical state. So for all G less than GC, meaning that, okay, the ground state should be a singlet, the first excitation should be a triplet at K equals pi. Okay, but now let's look at this VBS state again. So in the thermodynamic limit, we would have these symmetry broken states that should be degenerate, or really if we look at it in terms of these linear combinations, these two states should be completely degenerate for infinite n. But as I mentioned, and I made the analogy with these double well single particle quantum mechanics states, for finite n, there's a splitting between those states. And the gap between them should close exponentially fast as we go to infinite size. So that actually means that if you look at the lowest excitation, it should actually be a singlet. Because these two states should come arbitrarily close to each other in the thermodynamic limit. Of course, in this chain, also this excitation energy goes to zero, but actually it goes to zero much slower, something like 1 over L, or 1 over N, as I call it. So the gap between these chains, these states, should close exponentially, and that gap should close as 1 over N, or sorry, that's in the Heisenberg chain. That should close as 1 over n. So the point here is that instead of the triplet being the lowest excitation, the singlet should actually be the lowest excitation in the VBS state. And one can actually see that. So if you take, similar to what you did in the tutorial yesterday, but now you do it for the J1, J2 chain, you look at the ground state energy as a function of the coupling ratio, and you get some result, and then you look at the two lowest excitations and you see that the triplet K equals pi is the lowest excitation here, but then this singlet excitation actually will cross that excitation. So what it means is that those two energies will actually cross at that point. So that crossing point can actually be taken as a finite size definition of this critical point. So if you extract the crossing for different system sizes and extrapolate it to infinite size as is done here, so it turns out that in this particular case, those crossings move at a rate 1 over n squared. That's also some result of these field theories, and you can see that one can actually extrapolate, in fact, extremely accurately to infinite size. So one can get this crossing point to, what do we have here, seven significant digits almost, just by doing this extrapolation. It works so well. So actually what I want you to do for the next homework, which I guess you will be given on Monday, you will do the tutorial and there will be some related homework, is to look at this kind of level crossings, but in a chain where we add one more interaction, just to make it slightly different from this one, and it will not be more difficult actually, it's quite simple to do it. And then you will use some, I mean you don't have to do it to this kind of precision, so just roughly extract this crossing point and extrapolate it. All right, so of course it would be nice to verify now that when you have this critical point So that corresponds to something like, let's see, something around here. If we could do very big system sizes, maybe we could see that also in this order parameter. One can, of course, try to analyze the finite size behavior of these correlations as well and really see if they decay to zero exactly at that point. But it's not actually easy, especially if you are limited to these system sizes. Okay, so let's look at another case. So this was now the Heisenberg chain, and we looked at this phase transition. Now let's look at a maybe slightly unusual situation. So we have discussed this Mermin-Wagner theorem, which told us that we cannot have order in these Heisenberg systems in one dimension. I don't know what's going on today. So the projector is somehow strange. Yeah. All right. It didn't happen before, but today is a bad day, it seems. So the Mermin-Wagner theorem tells us we cannot have long-range order in 1D. So we cannot have an L state in 1D. But that's if we have short-range interactions. So if we put in some long enough range interactions, then we can actually have an L order also in one dimension. So there was a recent work on that, and it's quite neat, so let me just discuss it a little bit. So what can one do in the Heisenberg chain? Well, we can add longer range interactions, and let's say we would like to have an L state where these spin correlations are long range. Then you clearly don't want to make it frustrated, because as we saw, the frustration works against these antiferromagnetic correlations. Actually, what one can do is to put in interactions that decay with distance as some power law, but we put a sign there which makes it non-frustrated, meaning if you just look at it classically, it would favor antiferromagnetic correlations. So here it's like the Heisenberg chain, but you see we sum over all the distances, spins up to all distances on the chain are coupled with each other. Well, here I truncated the sum at n over 2. One can do other things as well with these infinite range interactions. So what they did also, they did 1 over r to some power, and they look at the system as a function of that power law. So if that alpha is small enough, it means that the interactions decay slowly enough, they actually could get an L state. And then they also looked at things as a function of this nearest neighbor coupling, keeping those fixed. Yeah?
What were the methods using which this Hamiltonian was investigated in
this paper? Oh, so they actually did, as I say, I think here, quantum Monte Carlo. Yeah, they did quantum Monte Carlo. Right. Well, they also, I mean, it was Ian Affleck, you know, so you see, he of course, does this low energy field theory. So they also, so they extracted this phase diagram and looked at all kinds of correlation functions and so on. And then they also developed a low energy field theory, and somehow it seemed to match. So if you want to know more about those field theories, this is actually quite a nice paper to look at. Yeah?
How do you get a ferromagnetic state out of...
Antiferromagnetic state.
But you said
The Nell state is an antiferromagnetic state.
Oh, sorry, I got those back.
Right there.
Sorry.
But that's okay. Yeah, so we want some interaction which is compatible with the antiferromagnetic Nell state. Yeah. Right. So they did quantum Monte Carlo, which we haven't talked about yet, but... that's okay. Actually, I want to show you something else related to diagonalization here too, but let me just point out then what they got for the phase diagram. So if we look at this power alpha again, so as that power is small enough, you get an L state, but it depends even on what this nearest neighbor coupling is. So it's not like this is so that you can say, well, what is long enough range of the interactions. You cannot characterize it just by an exponent. It depends on details of the system. So you see the critical alpha goes from 2, maybe, I don't know what the limit will be here, but clearly it depends on this lambda. So this is a funny phase transition because this is a really long-range ordered state, and as we already discussed today, the Heisenberg chain itself is critical, and this whole region is critical. So you have a critical phase here, not just a critical point. Yeah?
Why did they choose 1 over R to the open, not land over R to the open? What would that be?
I think it would just be the same thing, just with, you know, when you plot the phase diagram, it would look a little bit different. So you say putting the lambda here.
Yeah.
And keeping this equal to 1, or?
Wouldn't.
Well, if you just put lambda in front of everything, it doesn't matter. If you put just a lambda here, it's just an overall energy scale. It would not change the ground state. Right?
Yes, okay.
Yeah. So here they have 2 independent parameters. Right. If lambda is here as well, there's only 1.
Okay.
Excuse me. Do we have a kind of a classical spontaneously symmetry breaking in this case? Because here we have a critical phase instead of a critical point.
Right. Yeah, so classically, I mean, this is actually similar to what you get in the two-dimensional XY model. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but let me mention it. In the two-dimensional XY model, so a classical XY model, as a function of temperature, there's what's called a Kostelitz-Tauless transition, where it's a phase transition, but not a phase transition into an ordered state, but into a critical state. So there's the spin correlations in that case go like 1 over R to some exponent, let's call it eta. And eta, I think, is a quarter here, and then eta becomes smaller and smaller here, and finally at t equals 0, you get through long-range order. But this is a critical phase. So in the Heisenberg chain is, well, even the phase transition that we discussed, the dimerization or VBS phase transition in the J1, J2 chain, it's a little bit similar to that TKT point, actually. So, yeah, so there's a classical analog here, at least qualitatively. All right. So also here they calculated exponents on this curve, and they depend on where you are on the curve here. So let me discuss now one related topic. So this is also actually to show you that, okay, this exact diagonalization is a sort of very old and simple way, but one can actually still publish papers just based on exact diagonalization. So this is something I did recently. So basically I wanted to see what are the combined effects of long-range interactions and frustrations. So if we combine this model that we discussed on the previous graph, oops, getting worse. With the J1, J2 model, what can we get? So here I take a similar interaction as in this work by Ian Affleck and collaborators, except I make J2 have the frustrating sign, so similar to the J1, J2 model. And I normalize these non-frustrated couplings in such a way that all those couplings sum up to 1. So in that case, if I let my alpha go to infinity, then I get back exactly the J1, J2 chain. So it's the J1, J2 chain with some other longer range interactions. And I don't include any lambda as was done in the previous case. So I keep the J1 always well, it's not fixed, but it's, yeah, it's a little bit convoluted because I normalize all the couplings. Anyway, so when we discuss quantum Monte Carlo, you will see that we cannot do quantum Monte Carlo for these frustrated models, right? And these long-range interactions are also quite challenging for other methods that normally work quite well in 1D, like this density matrix RG method. So I will just quickly show what I got here for the phase diagram. So this line here is the same J1, J2 chain that we just looked at. So we have this dimerization transition, and then we have the VBS state here. I didn't discuss the fact that if we look at the spin correlations in the VBS state, they actually change a little bit too. So in some region here, that the spin correlations are at k equals pi, meaning they are staggered. You get this up, down, down sort of pattern. But then they actually change to period 4 at some point. So the momentum is, if you do the Fourier transform, the peak is at pi over 2. So then what I found is that, okay, you can do the same trick with the level crossings, and you can study a transition between this Heisenberg-like critical state and the VBS using level crossings. But at some point, that actually changes, and you get something similar to what Affleck et al. Get. You get this antiferromagnetic Knell state if this alpha is small enough. So here I plot alpha minus 1. Actually, this corresponds to this curve corresponds to the previous model at lambda equals to 1. I just have a different parameterization here, so that's why their model corresponds to the curve in this phase diagram. So one would expect, based on their results, some antiferromagnetic state. And then what I found is that actually at that point where that happens, the order of the phase transition actually changes. So now it becomes actually a first-order phase transition between a VBS, a kind of VBS, and the Knell state. So this is the kind of level crossings one gets, similar to what we saw in the J1, J2 chain. If alpha is large, you can again follow that crossing and extract the phase boundary. But now something interesting happens. If alpha is small, so here I show alpha equals 1, you get some qualitative change in the shape of these curves. So what you see here is that it becomes very sharp. This peak that was rounded here becomes actually very sharp here. And it's actually not infinitely sharp. If I look at this in detail, I mean, here's a detail of it, but even here you don't see it. But it's actually what's called an avoided level crossing. So it's the same kind of thing as here, that the ground state just has a maximum, but it becomes very, very sharp. But it's a little bit rounded if you look at it in detail. So there's another level here which doesn't cross with it exactly. It's an avoided level crossing, so there's a little bit of a gap between them. And this actually corresponds to this first order transition. Oops, sorry. So when that happens, those avoided level crossings looking like that normally correspond to first order transitions. So one can actually analyze, if one looks at, for example, the second derivative, let's look at it here, the second derivative of the energy at this maximum, one can see that for this case here, for example, it's just some convergent number, and here, as a function of system size, it diverges. It shows that this becomes really infinitely sharp. So there's a first-order transition. Yep.
Didn't Tankard to obtain a point where the levels cross for the system?
Okay, it depends on the system size, of course. And because if the system size is large, the Lanczos calculation for each coupling takes a long time. but for example, what I want you to do in the homework.
Yeah, for example, a person may take a lot of time to obtain
this diagram for all.
Right, right, but mainly because you want, if you do something for, you know, serious research, you want to do the largest systems you can. For example, let me go back to the J1J2 case. If we look at this level crossing here, this is for n equals 16, right? And that takes no time at all. If you do lanches for n equals 16, it's very fast. So you can do, you know, 10, 15 points, whatever you need to extract that crossing point to whatever level of precision you feel is necessary. And you see it converges very, very quickly here. So even if you don't have those largest sizes, you can still do it quite well. So actually, for what you will do in your homework, I'm not going to ask you to do, do this on that level. It's just roughly extracting it. Okay. So, but actually, it should be pointed out that often in these model systems that we look at, things behave very well. Like if we look at a dicing model, we'll analyze the critical point. You remember that, okay, it really worked quite well. And in the J1, J2 model, that crossing point extrapolated very, very nicely. Now, here those crossing points don't extrapolate as nicely. So these data here correspond to the crossing points, and you can see that they go like more or less like 1 over L, not 1 over L squared as they did before. And it's actually not really possible to extrapolate this to great accuracy. In what you will be doing, you will not deal with the infinite range interaction, so it will not be so bad. But it will not probably look as nice as just for the J1, J2 model. So this is just to show that, okay, at least roughly one can extrapolate those crossing points. And we can also look at how that position of the energy maximum moves. So this is the maximum here, it's rounded. Here the maximum is sort of sharp. But in both cases we can look at the peak position and how it moves. So from these results also it does appear that the first order transition happens when the peak actually has moved to where the crossing occurs, and at the same point that peaks become very sharp. Okay, now let's look at the correlation. So in this case where we have an L to VBS transition, as I think we have for small alpha, we can again look at correlation functions. So this is what I think is an L phase. So this is actually at alpha equals, what is it, do I say here? I think it's alpha equals 1.5 or 1, I forget now. Anyway, this corresponds to a point in the nail phase, and you see that these spin correlations are sine oscillating, right? And they appear to be long ranged, so it really shows looks like a nail state. Whereas on the other side of the transition, actually, you see that the correlations have a periodicity 4, and they seem to decay with the distance, but decaying pretty slowly. So it could be some kind of critical spin state, but with a different momentum. Okay, let's look at the dimer correlations. In the nail state, you have almost no signal in the dimer correlation, but at that larger coupling, you see something indicative of a VBS. And if you take the Fourier transform of these correlations, so here the peak in the Fourier transform is at pi over 2, pi for the nail state and pi over 2 for the red ones. and you can also Fourier transform these correlations, of course, and then you can look at it as a function of this coupling G, the frustration, and here you can clearly see that it's a first order transition. These things jump very sharply, unlike what they do in the J1, J2 chain. We saw that these things actually, so this is a similar quantity, but here I just look at the longest distance, but I could do the Fourier transform as well. It would be very smooth regardless. So it's completely different, clearly first order. Okay, so I think we have to leave 2D to next time. So yes, please.
Why do you have a negative correlation for this case?
This one? Yeah, actually that's quite interesting. It's because okay, so I think it's because if we have a dimerized state, normally this corresponds to singlet more or less, right? Singlet and so on. I think in this case actually what you get is almost like singlet, triplet, singlet, triplet. So the correlations here are actually ferromagnetic, which is what you see from from the spin as well. So you see that the spin correlations, the spin correlations also, well, they have period 4. So I think one should think of this VBS as actually something where you have almost like you have spins that are like that, but then on the next bond they go ferromagnetic. Then you would get actually positive and negative values there. But actually this is not, it's not quite clear yet that that's the picture, but it could be. Okay, so next time I want to do 2D diagonalization a little bit, and then we will start doing quantum Monte Carlo as well. All right.